Even if you never use marijuana, you're probably well aware of the growth of the business in both of our states. In some communities, you can't drive a mile without seeing the green cross signifying a dispensary selling pot. And on many rural roads, you see the high fences and greenhouses that mark a cannabis growing operation. Cannabis, marijuana, choose your term, is legal in both states for both medical and personal use, but with some caveats. For one thing, not all of the various wrinkles in laws and regulations have been smoothed out. So let's explore where things stand with a guest from each state. Danica Hipschman is the Director of Statewide Licensing for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, OLCC, which is responsible for the licensing of the recreational program. Danica, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We also have with us Brooke Staggs, who is not a regulator herself, but covers the industry extensively. She's an award-winning cannabis writer for The Californian. She took top honors in the Best of the West contest explanatory writing category for her reporting in 2016 on California's cannabis legalization efforts. Brooke, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, glad to be here.
So let's start with you, Brooke. I mean, since the law passed in California, how much of a transformation in the activity you cover?
It's been very much a transition year. So a lot of what's happening right now has been behind the scenes. January 1st is, you know, the date that recreational sales can start, that licenses will kick in for medical businesses. So a lot of what we've been seeing is, you know, the state regulators and then local governments rushing to put in policies and regulations before that January 1st deadline.
So you can grow your own at this point, but you can't officially buy it as a recreational product?
That's right. Yeah. So the personal rights associated with Prop 64 kicked in the day after it passed, which was a year ago today. Timely for us to be talking. And so as of that date, folks can possess up to an ounce, and they can grow up to 6 plants per household if they're 21 and over.
All right. And is there any, so you can't have any more than those amounts on hand at any given time?
That's right. If you grow at home and you have more than that, you know, from those 6 plants, you just have to keep it, you know, locked up, out of reach of kids and public view and things like that. But even the home grow rule does allow for local governments to weigh in and regulate that. So they can, for instance, clearly ban people's ability to grow those 6 plants outside. And so a lot of cities up and down the state are doing that. And then some are going even further and requiring permits and, you know, other restrictions on how people can grow those plants. And that's one area that's caused some controversy. There's actually a lawsuit pending in one of our cities over a policy where people would have to pay a $411 fee to get a permit, agree to let regulators come in and inspect their home and things like that. So the ACLU is involved in a lawsuit there with the city of Fontana over that policy.
How much of a patchwork then is it from place to place? I mean, basically when you cross a city line, you have to wonder what the marijuana laws are there.
You do. Yeah, there's no regularity to it at all. You know, we'll see one county where there's one city that allows businesses, and, you know, next one over, there could be half of the cities that allow some type of business. So it definitely is a patchwork, and it seems to be growing more of a patchwork every day. There's a new story about a new city putting a new regulation and policy in place.
Danica Hipschman, I know you're not responsible for the local regulation since you are with OLCC, but is it pretty much a patchwork in Oregon as well?
It is, because part of the statutes that were passed by the Oregon legislature allowed local jurisdictions to opt out of it, and a number of them did, so they could pass ordinances that would prohibit either all license types, the entire supply chain, or just certain types from being passed. In Oregon, the allowance for individuals to grow their 4 plants isn't necessarily affected by those local ordinances, but local communities can put parameters around how those personal grows are conducted.
So the transition from both states had medical marijuana programs, and then both passed the recreational use. And so is there still a medical program in existence, Danica Hipschman?
There is still a medical program very much in existence. And, you know, in Southern Oregon in particular, you know, there are a lot of grows, as everyone knows. Not many of them are actually licensed grows with OLCC, only about 300 of them. So the remaining grows would be medical. There was legislation passed this last summer that is going to require that all medical grows actually be tracked within our seed-to-sale tracking system. So there's a deadline coming up of December 1st that any medical growers that want to continue in the medical program will have to start tracking, have to declare that they're going to track within the medical system by December 1st.
Is there much incentive for a grower to stay in the medical system versus opting into the OLCC system? And is it possible to do that?
It is possible to opt into the OLCC system. A medical grower can apply for a license really at any point, and quite a few of the producers that we have in our recreational system came from the medical program. So it's been a pretty common transition for a lot of folks. It really is just up to the individual grower whether they want to stay in the medical or in the recreational system. There certainly are a lot of requirements that they have to follow in the recreational system that are different than what they have to do on the medical side. So it really is up to the individual grower.
What kinds of requirements in the recreational system that didn't exist in the medical or doesn't?
It's particularly for the growers, there's a lot more security requirements on the recreational side. They have to have 24/7 camera coverage of all of their product. They have to have alarm systems. There's also a more robust, I think, vetting process in terms of background checking the individual people involved with the grow.
How much of this comes from law and how much from regulation? I know that the law did pass in one form in November of 2014. The legislature came in winter of 2015 and made some changes right away. So even with what the legislature specified after the law passed, did OLCC still have to do a bunch of rulemaking on the fly, essentially?
We did. The legislature came in 2015 and very, very much revised Measure 91 that was passed in 2014. OLCC had to put in pretty comprehensive rules as directed by the legislature. It's really kind of a mixture of both in terms of what the requirements are for getting a license between what's in statute and what's in rule.
So let's talk about what it takes to get a license to we're talking about for sales. You have licenses for several different aspects of things, right?
Correct. We have what we call them producers on the recreational side. They're called growers on the medical side. That's kind of how we differentiate the two. But they're the ones that actually grow the plants. And then we have the processors. Those are the ones that make the edible products, the extracts, concentrates, topicals, those sorts of things. We have a wholesale license, which we kind of call our catch-all license. They can do the transportation. They can purchase from multiple growers or processors and sell to retail in bulk. And then we have the retailers, that's the only license type that can sell to the general public. And finally, we have a laboratories, which is a very critical part of our system because we do have pretty robust testing requirements. We also do have the possibility for a research certificate, although we haven't issued any of those to date.
I can't imagine Danica Hipschman, like the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, had a lot of people without much to do. So have you had to staff up to handle all these new areas to license and new places to visit to check out the licensing requirements?
It has been a very busy couple of years here at OLCC. When the measure was initially passed in 2014, there was a lot of work that went into trying to figure out how many licenses we anticipated. And so looking at Washington and Colorado in particular, I think the estimate was somewhere between 800 and 1,000. And so we were given some staffing kind of based on those estimates, very quickly blew past them. I think we're up well over 3,000 applications at this point, and they continue to come in. It wasn't until this year that we were given additional staffing of about 40, which the agency is working on hiring for right now. So it's been a very exciting and busy time. We've really had to take an all-hands-on-deck approach, utilizing a lot of our liquor resources just to get licenses issued and deal with compliance issues as they've come in.
But you said 40 new staff is what you're authorized for?
A little over 40 new staff.
Wow.
So we're hiring.
All right. We are talking about marijuana regulation in both of our states. Danica Hipschman is the Director of Statewide Licensing for OLCC, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Brooke Staggs joins us on the California side. She's an award-winning cannabis writer for The Californian. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions or comments, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Brooke, give us a sense of whether there's a scramble on in California to do the sorts of things that OLCC just talked about for Oregon.
There definitely is, and there's been skepticism since the legalization measure passed last fall about whether we would be able to get this all together in time for that January 1st start. So where we're at right now, we actually did have separate regulations for medical and recreational, but this summer a bill was passed along with the budget that merged the two. So there really isn't a distinction at this point between the regulations for the two different groups. The one difference is that folks who are medical patients will be exempted from state sales tax. But other than that, so far, we're still waiting on final regulations. Those are supposed to be out sometime this month, hopefully the middle of this month. And then from there, the state plans to, in early December, start accepting applications for temporary licenses. And that was kind of a stopgap that they created so that they could stick to that January 1st timeline, knowing that they weren't going to be able to get the full requirements for the licenses up and going by that date. So businesses should be able to start filling out those applications in December, and then on January 1st, they'll start, the state agency will start emailing those folks back and letting them know if they're clear to start operating for a recreational business and if they have a temporary permit for the medical site as well.
Okay, so a bit of a stopgap kind of thing to go on through December into January, just to get to make sure that there are some places set up to sell. But given the preponderance of medical marijuana, particularly in Southern California, is there, I mean, are these places all going to opt to get into the recreational system from what you've seen?
The vast majority that I've talked to, you know, if they have the option, if the city or county that they're in allows them to get into the recreational side, they certainly intend to do that. But there are definitely more cities at this point that are allowing medical businesses than recreational. Some are more hesitant, you know, to get into that side of things. But if there are cities that are allowing medical sales right now, there are, you know, quite a number of them that are considering allowing them to sell recreational once those licenses start as well.
You had mentioned a couple of bits of regulation that have to drop it. In fact, California is waiting in part, I understand, on an environmental impact report.
That, and they actually did just get the results of that in, so that part of the hurdle is cleared, and now it's just waiting for them to issue those emergency regulations.
Why was the environment...
should be within the next...
All right, so an EIR is going to come out under CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act. Why was that required as part of a marijuana thing?
Mostly on the cultivation side. So, you know, there have been obviously a lot of harms done in the past by illegal grows taking place, you know, mostly in Northern California, mm-hmm. with pesticides and different pollutions causing, you know, getting into the waterways and folks diverting water, you know, that shouldn't have been and things like that. And so they did a pretty robust look at whether the policies in place for these regulated businesses, if they follow the laws, it's in place, will that fix these harms? You know, will it be not harmful for the environment under this route? And the report essentially said yes, that, you know, if they stick to the law, that should take care of most of the concerns.
Is there a concern, though, that a lot of people will opt to stay in the dark, though, and to still run a business that sends marijuana out of state in contravention of the law?
Yeah, that's definitely a big concern. I mean, we've seen numbers that as much as 80% of the cannabis that's grown in California now goes outside of the state. You know, we just simply can't consume as much as we're growing as, you know, the biggest grower in the nation and possibly even beyond. And so there's definitely a concern, you know, about how many of those folks will come into the regulated market. Especially there's been quite a bit of chatter lately about the tax issue. And if, you know, with the state tax rate is at 15%, and then cities are also allowed to tack on their own additional taxes if they'd like to. And so you can see that, you know, that can pretty quickly escalate. And if that rate is too high and it drives up prices, that gives, you know, more of an incentive for that black market to survive and possibly, you know, not do what voters intended for Prop 64 to do, which was to, you know, bring those businesses into a regulated market.
We're talking about marijuana on both sides of the state line with new regulations coming all the time and California starting recreational sales on January 1st of 2018. Brooke Staggs is a writer for the Californian. She's won awards for her work covering cannabis in California. Danica Hipschman is with us as well, the director of statewide licensing for OLCC, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. When we talk about the cultivation part of things, Danica Hipschman, I remember thinking as I was getting into the research for this segment that there probably must be limits to expertise. I mean, how do you get help from places like the Department of Agriculture in figuring out, you know, the source of the stuff that's coming into the market that the OLCC then regulates?
We did. You know, I think that was one thing that our agency recognized really early on when we were tasked with putting together the recreational program, that as much as the agency knows about regulating alcohol, marijuana was just a whole new animal. So throughout most of 2015, we did a lot of outreach to the industry, law enforcement, other stakeholders, and all, including our sister agencies, OHA, that has been operating the medical program for a long time, and the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And there is a lot of expertise in this state from a lot of different sources, and it certainly has bolstered our own understanding of how the product is grown, dynamics within the market, and I think done a lot for us to be able to be as welcoming as we can to a lot of the medical growers that may be nervous about moving into the recreational market.
Are there large gray areas, though, Began, given that cannabis is still a Schedule I narcotic on the federal list and therefore technically illegal? At the federal level, I mean, and therefore banned from large bits of research, it seems like there'd be lots of areas that wouldn't have been known, or at least not well published. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, certainly. You know, and I think, you know, the Oregon legislature, you know, adopted as part of its purpose statement the principles of the Cole Memorandum, and that's certainly something that the OLCC has used as a backdrop to all the rules that we adopt to try and keep that separation between the state. You know, what the state has desired to do versus what the federal government has desired to do. But there certainly is some gray area. I think we had been hoping that the research certificate that we were given the option to give to people would be taken advantage of, because that does provide an avenue to do some research into it more.
And have people taken advantage of those?
We have received a couple of applications that don't quite meet where we need them to go. So, no, it really hasn't been something that has been pursued to this point.
Let us take a call. We have Mark in Reading on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Danica Hipschman and Brooke Staggs. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. I would like to know if under California law it's legal for a person that's growing at home to give away any of the marijuana he grows, and if that's regulated locally as well as statewide.
Okay, good question there. Thanks for that, Mark. Appreciate it. Brooke, what do you know about that in California?
So folks are allowed to gift up to an ounce at a time to anyone else that's 21 and over. And so there's nothing in the law that says that the local government can regulate that at all. So, you know, they can regulate how it's grown and how it's stored, but in terms of giving it away to somebody else, that's free and clear under Prop 64.
I'm still a little mystified by, and this is in both states, by the amounts you're supposed to own no more than, and like what, an ounce and four plants, is it generally? That's what it is in California, right, Brooke?
An ounce and six plants.
Six plants, okay. So, but, you know, you've used up part of your ounce, and you've smoked part of your six plants, and so you've got less now. I mean, so then where are you supposed to go to get more?
So right now, I mean, you would have to be a medical patient in order to go, you know, buy it from a dispensary if you needed more than what you're able to grow, or if, you know, you simply can't or choose not to grow at home. And then, of course, as of January 1st, there should, you know, be some stores that will allow recreational sales as well. But yeah, you're allowed to, you know, always have up to an ounce. So if you, you know, use part of that stash, you can go buy more, you know, to make up the difference.
All right, but
a little bit less than an ounce.
It's not like going to the warehouse store, you know, where you can, you know, buy up to 20 ounces in advance and then just, you know, have an ounce a week or something.
No, yeah, the stores will only sell you that amount as well, because, you know, that's all that you're allowed to possess. And that'll be, you know, particularly important as you're driving. If you're driving from a shop to your house, you definitely don't want to have more than an ounce on you, because that is the legal limit. And there is still a lot of stuff to be worked out in terms of driving laws. But, you know, essentially right now, as long as you have less than an ounce and you treat it kind of like alcohol, where it's, you know, kept in a sealed container, it's not accessible, obviously not being used by you as a driver, then you should be safe. But if you have more than an ounce, that would definitely get you into some tricky territory.
Okay, we have a question here from Mike in Medford, who didn't stay on the line, but it's a question for you, Danica, at the OLCC. He wants to know if they'll be tightening of regulations on residential grows. He says his neighbors grow in an open backyard, which creates an unpleasant smell. And I have heard this many, many times since marijuana got legalized in Oregon, and I'm sure you have too.
We have heard it, you know, and this is really one of those areas where it really is a local issue that OLCC, you know, by statute really doesn't have any authority to regulate. The personal grow provision of Measure 91 and the subsequent statutes is somewhat sacrosanct in terms of, you know, that you can do it, and local jurisdictions cannot prohibit from having personal grows. They can't set parameters around it, and a lot of, you know, jurisdictions have in terms of passing smell ordinances or site ordinances for that type of thing. OLCC really only regulates those that have actually gotten a recreational license.
Okay, so it's really a business sort of transaction, not the local stuff. Brooke Staggs, in California, then, is there a fair amount of, like, geez, my neighbor's yard smells stuff going on?
Yeah, we definitely get that. I mean, even, you know, before growing, we, you know, with smoking, we definitely hear that. And it, same thing here. It's up to local cities. We've seen some that have started to try to pass these smell ordinances. And, you know, other than that, it's been essentially treated like a nuisance complaint. You know, if you live in an apartment building, the landlord, the apartment owner certainly has the right to say that folks can't, you know, smoke or grow inside of that property. So that's one way to address it. It's, you know, a little trickier if you're in a single family home, then it would be up to the city to pass a rule against that.
Now, I noticed, Danica, I read your piece from, I think it was October, about a session put on by regulators in Riverside. Got a massive turnout, it looks like.
I'm sorry, what date was that?
I'm sorry, Brooke.
We've done a couple of them lately.
It was Brooke I was talking to.
Oh, sorry.
There was a series of hearings at state regulators. So we actually have three different state agencies that are overseeing the different types of licenses. So our Bureau of Cannabis Control oversees retail sales, testing, and distribution. And then our Department of Agriculture oversees the growers, and our Department of Public Health oversees the manufacturers. And so those three agencies have been, you know, having meetings, letting people know a little bit about what the process is going to go like to get licensed. And they had the first one in Los Angeles, and they had thousands of people turn up, had to, you know, turn people away because they couldn't fit in the building. Some of them came to Riverside the next day, and same thing. There were lines around the block of people that want to get licenses in this industry and are, you know, just trying to find out what the rules are going to be, since it's kind of happening so last minute.
Sure. Danica Hipschman, as you set up in Oregon, did you get the same sort of response from lots of people flocking out to find out what was going to go on?
We did. We did a series of road shows a couple times over the last couple of years, and the same responses, you know, just really overwhelming, people really interested in learning everything they can about the regulated market.
Now, I noticed, too, that it's a compliance before enforcement, so OLC's emphasis at this point is more on education?
It is. You know, we really do want to be as welcoming as we can to those that want to enter the market and do it legally. So that is the approach we've been taking so far, and it seems to have been pretty successful.
All right. More to come on cannabis being legal in both states, with recreational sales starting on January 1st in California. Brooke Staggs covers California for The Californian. Danica Hipschman is OLCC's Director of Statewide Licensing. Thank you both for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.